Hey veterans, one quick note before today's show. I'd love to know how I can better support you in the veteran community. If you have any suggestions, it could be a guest or a guest type you'd like interviewed, it could be a particular challenge you're facing that doesn't currently have a good solution, or it could even be data you'd love to be investigated. Whatever it is, drop me a line at beyondtheuniform.io or on email at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, and I'll do my best to help out. Thanks and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 62 with Hank Hughes.
You know, there's like a lot of weird stress things that come from like all this tension, but being able to take your wife to the Oscars and being able to take my interpreter and like give her something like that, I mean, one of the like most unadulterated good feelings I've ever had.
The top reason to listen to today's episode is Oscars. Since Hank was in high school, he dreamed of making movies. He kept this vision alive during his time in the Army, and when he got out, he took action. And his hard work paid off. Through the American Corporate Partners, who I mention at the end of each episode, he was paired with legendary director George Lucas as a mentor. And he was nominated for an Academy Award for his short film, Day One. I cannot think of a career that is more different than military service as the film industry, and it's really incredible to hear Hank's journey and success in this industry. As always at beyondtheuniform.io, there are other episodes and resources for veterans, as well as the show notes with timestamps for each topic we cover and links to Hank's movie and more. And with that, let's dive in to my interview with Hank Hughes. All right, well, joining me today in Los Angeles is Hank Hughes. Hank, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to give everyone a quick background on you. Hank is an Oscar-nominated writer and director who spent 5 years as a paratrooper in the 173rd Airborne, conducting two combat tours in Afghanistan. His unit was featured in The Outpost by Jake Tapper. Hank was featured in ABC News' Standing Up for Heroes with Bob Woodruff, where he was paired with George Lucas as part of American Corporate Partners' National Mentoring Program. He earned an MFA in directing at the American Film Institute, where he received the Gary Winnick Scholarship. His work has played at Telluride, AFI Fest, Mill Valley, and Cannes, among others. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife. Hank, anything, first of all, to correct or add to that background?
No, it's, I mean, I guess there's more to the story than that, but that's a good place to start. I don't know.
Awesome. Well, I have to give you and the audience two quick disclosures before we dive in. First is I follow movies the way some people follow sports, and so the Oscars to me is like the Super Bowl. I host a party every year, so the fact that you've been there is pretty awesome. And then, you know, like most people, I grew up watching Star Wars on repeat and collected action figures, had hundreds of them, including the Millennium Falcon. And so the fact that you were able to,
right? That's good.
Oh man. Yeah. The AT-AT everything. But you, you having worked with George Lucas, man, I am, I just want you to be warned. I'm in awe of you for many reasons. I just wanted to get that out there and up front.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of, I feel very fortunate. It's kind of the short answer to all of that.
Awesome.
You know, it's, a lot of that came from just being the right place at the right time and, being ready to show up, I suppose. Mm.
Well, maybe to start off, take us back to that moment when you decided to leave the Army. Where were you and how did you approach that decision?
So basically I thought I'd only do one tour, and then basically I had, my timeline was wrong with the unit, so I ended up going on the second tour, which was great. It was wonderful for me and I learned a lot there, but I kind of knew as like we were about to redeploy, I was like, okay, well, I'm getting out of the Army now. And I don't know. I mean, I guess, what was I thinking then? I was thinking about things that I thought were important that probably weren't. That's probably, I could start there. But I knew that for me, like, it was also tied around this woman. I had just started dating her, and I knew that we were going to become partners in life. And we ended up getting married a few years later. And so it was all like this big thing of like her and no Army, and then trying to find how to make the film thing work. And I finally rested on, you know, taking a quick look of myself of like, who am I? What am I good at? And I know that I'm much better in structured scenarios, or, you know, like I do well in training, for instance. Maybe that's a byproduct of being, I was an Army brat and being raised around that, and also like being in the military. But it's something like the hardest thing for me lately has been to try and embrace the sort of individuality of the entrepreneur. Or the individualism, really, like how that's like this, it's very different from this other like military thing. Anyway, so I said, okay, I need to find something that'll give me some structure. And I thought, okay, I did some research and found out about the American Film Institute. And it was sort of a graduate school for, at least this is how I read into it, and it is advertised as such, but for people who've already had a life, essentially. Like it's not meant for people who are going from college to graduate school. So it's like you're supposed to have kind of like a chapter beyond academia. And I feel like that was good. That suited me. And it was like I'd be surrounded by my peers as opposed to having – I know some people who've gone back to school. I think especially if you were enlisted and hadn't gone to undergraduate. I think when you got out of the military and like went to undergrad, it felt like you probably felt like a lot like Billy Madison or something. but luckily I didn't have that. So, but that's, I knew when I was getting out to like start looking at where I was going. But that said, like the timing of that still sucked because I had to wait a year to go to school. And a part of it is I kind of wish I'd gone straight into it. Insofar as like it probably would have been faster or such. But the fact is that I learned a lot of lessons in that year where I couldn't just go to this school and try and like figure things out, where I had to like, oh, now you're in Los Angeles. How do you find work? You know, all the things that you're good at, they're not hiring for here. And then trying to transition that expertise into something that was very difficult, and also embracing the idea that it was just you're kind of out there on your own to like figure out how the lay of the land and how you can find your space inside of that.
Did you, you know, I had read that you had wanted to be a filmmaker since you were in high school, and was that an active dream when you were in the Army? Was there things you
Absolutely.
Were doing to like further that while on active duty? And how did you keep that alive?
You know, I mean, from time to time I would write. I mean, if I was a good soldier, like I met a guy the other day, Brian Anthony. He's a TV writer. He's also a former Green Beret and I believe a Ranger as well. And he was smart, where he had already had like 2-3 scripts written, I think, by the time he got out, which is important to have like this sort of it's kind of like a walking around with your resume. It's like, here I have these things and people think they're good or bad and they can judge you on them and they can get work or not get work from them. So he was super smart about it. But what I kind of did is I just tried to take note of anything that I thought was moving, you know, or that that touched me. And because I knew that one day I'd want to try and use that or express something about that when I made a movie or told a story. Other than that, I mean, just watching a ton of movies, still reading a lot. But I didn't really – actually, I did make one movie while I was in Afghanistan. It's a little nerdy, actually. I took like a Super 8 camera and shot some stuff. And then I took a a Nikon, just an old 35mm camera for still frames. And I just would practice with that from time to time, like particularly on my first tour, we were just up on, you know, for months at a time, you'd be on this one kind of remote OP, just you and your platoon. And so there was, you know, when you're snowed in, there's not much to do. So I was able to do some of that while I was there. But mostly the Army was a full-time job, as I'm sure everyone knows.
It seems like regardless of whether someone aspires to be a filmmaker, like what a great way to try, what a great ambition for going through life of just trying to find those moments of beauty and those moments of emotion and just paying attention for those. I feel like that's such a great aspiration. This is the California part of me, but it seems like such a great aspiration yeah. just in general. And what was it like applying to the American Film Institute, and particularly any advice you would have for someone who would like to apply to that sort of program?
Sure. Let's see here. What can I say about that? You know, it's most of these sort of programs are going to have a requirement that you have made something. You know, I would say most of those programs are going to have a requirement that you have previous work, that you can articulate what it is you want to do inside of that space. They're all kind of looking for something specific about you that will be indicative of who you are as a storyteller. Often people thought like, it's like, what is your voice is kind of the shorthand there. And so I would say that above all things, especially from trying to get into a an MFA program, it's, you know, what makes you different, or maybe even better, like, what is it about you that's interesting? And it's a hard thing because it's like you don't really, you can't really see the forest and the trees of yourself. But if you try hard enough, you realize like I was raised in the military. Both my parents were in. Like I am from a very interesting, distinct culture that doesn't have much in the way of like. We just don't see much that takes place in that space that is beyond the kind of typical Army stuff, which is great too. I love a lot of those movies or TV shows, but it's very much almost exclusively about combat, you know. But there's something that like, what is that thing about you that is that makes you so specific? It's kind of a silly thing almost to articulate, but that's what it comes down to. Because there's like, I guess what I've realized trying to become a filmmaker is that there are a ton of people trying to tell stories. People love to tell stories. People love to listen to stories. But it's how you can actually make it so that your voice gets heard.
Was that like a discovery process for you, of this continuous process of figuring out what your voice was? And
you know, I still can't answer that question, like what it is. Mm-hmm. I just know that when I find something that moves me or touches me, like, oh, like that is, I am interested in those sort of things. I didn't realize that. Or it's very hard to like kind of manage yourself in that way. But you have to have some barometer for it because, I mean, your job is to satisfy the audience, but also like kind of like figure out a lot of that comes from satisfying your own taste.
Yeah.
And so really understanding your own taste is important too. I mean, I still think like, for me, like it's always about the audience experience because it is I just can't get beyond the idea of like communication is all about listening. And so I want to make sure that I'm communicating in a way that people understand. But I do think that beyond the mechanism of this, like communicating, there is like this authenticity or this like unique quality or interest or something that's just, you know, that's really human. Like that comes from someone trying to figure out what it is that makes them tick. I think
that's great. And so what did you do? How did you fill that year between getting out of the Army and starting at film school?
Oh man, it was a bad year actually. It was a lot of like sitting around trying to figure out what life was. I feel like a lot of people have this sort of thing when they get out of college or high school maybe, and they have this sort of realization that, like, for instance, my little brother just graduated college. He moved to Texas. And, you know, it's like, where are all his friends? Where are all his like social activities? Where is like this support system that you kind of had your entire life? And so I think when you leave the military, you do that in almost like a delayed sort of way. And I certainly didn't anticipate how kind of lonely it would be and how frustrating it could become to like to not get work, for instance, especially like in my career field, where it's not like you don't get hired for a job and then it's like a paycheck and it's 9 to 5. Everything is like you get a job for this short amount of time and you have to find another one. And so trying to understand that game was incredibly difficult for me. I mean, luckily I had a tremendous support system in my wife, who had, you know, was incredibly successful in her own right working in the fashion industry. And so there were about 6 months there where like, I mean, I wasn't really working. I was trying to find work and trying to understand how to make all this work out. But it was difficult. And I think a lot of veterans have that sort of I kind of sat around for a month or so. So I definitely had that period.
Being on the other side of that now, do you have any advice for someone, let's say someone listening is just on the verge of getting out? What would you say to them about that initial period right afterwards?
You know, there's a big separation between anticipating something and experiencing something. Like I totally anticipated that I was going to be like, I mean, I believe in data. I believe in trends. It's going to be a rough transition. That's what they always say. And so I anticipated it. So I thought if I could anticipate it, I could thereby avoid it. And that is just inherently not the case. And there's a whole emotional spectrum on this thing too. That's like, you know, I went from being in this like kind of tribal society of like always being around like guys in my platoon or just in my unit, like there was this like camaraderie sort of quality to now you're just all alone. And the emotional effect that that has on you, you cannot outthink. And so my advice would be to like just understand you have to at some point deal with those feelings and like that isolation or that frustration of not being the successful like soldier you once were, a Marine or seaman or whatever, airman, excuse me, sailor. You know, there's, you just can't, I thought I could outthink that. And I think I almost wasted more time getting more upset thinking that I could out maneuver somehow this transition period that everyone finds is difficult. You know, it inherently is going to be so. And so I would just take it a day at a time. And if you can, have some sort of like long-term goal. I mean, it's no different than like the whole, you know, what's your 25-meter target, what's your 100-meter target. Like there was having that, I think, certainly helped me. It was an old language I could fall back on of like, okay, well, it's a crappy few months, but I know I'm going to go to this college or this film institute. So that's good. Okay. And like I had something to work towards. And so for me, I knew that being goal-oriented was a way to kind of get me out of that that limbo.
And where in your story does this whole ABC News standing up for heroes come along, where you get paired with George Lucas? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so that was – so I had about a year out of the Army before I went to AFI. And then about like sixth or seventh month mark, I was probably like kind of at this like – I would say my lowest, like, I don't know what I'm doing here in Los Angeles. And that's when I actually got a text message from our mutual friend, Tom Pei, who I was in the 173rd with. We were in the same unit. We were good friends. And he's like, hey, you should check out this thing, American Corporate Partners. And I completely I think I ignored it for like a month, which is so advantageous. Because when I did finally sign up, they were like, they did the interview for it, and they were like, well, what are you interested, who are you interested in like finding as a mentor? Because that's what they do. They give aspiring veterans in a particular field a mentor from that field. And I was like, well, I'd love to meet a director, shadow one, or just like, you know, kind of have conversations. And I assumed that I would get something along the lines of like a, you know, it's a working professional in Hollywood. And then they came, they emailed me back like, about a month later, a week or so later, I can't remember how long it was. And it was like, hey, do you feel comfortable being on television? And I thought, and they kind of said like, it would be, we would basically, they kind of said that Bob Woodruff was going to take over, or highlight six veterans. And they had found, for lack of a better term, celebrity mentors. And so I was like, wow. I mean, I really didn't want to be on camera, honestly, but like, I think that would be a silly reason to forfeit such an opportunity. So I said yes, and they didn't tell me who it was. But then they flew me up to Northern California, and I could start narrowing it down a little bit who it could be. And then basically Bob, who's a fantastic guy, you know, he's done an insane amount of work for veterans. As you may or may not know, he was he was wounded in Iraq, you know, had a whole TBI recovery. And so, like, I mean, I high-five that guy anytime I can. He's a really cool dude, and he's been very good to me. And basically, he told me in this theater that it was going to be during this interview that it was going to be George Lucas. And I was just, like, ecstatic, obviously, because, I mean, look, I want to tell stories. I don't ever think that I can do what he did, nor do I really want to on some level. Like Star Wars isn't even a movie. It's like this other thing that's like a part of our culture. It's like, it's myth, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And I was, and to have the ability to talk to someone who had created a myth, like that is, that's a very interesting opportunity and one I was very grateful to take. And so, yeah, I got to go hang out on the Skywalker Ranch and I met George. We sat down and talked for about an hour or so. And then I came back a few more times over the next year. I'd always go back up to the ranch. I'd drive from L.A. And we would just kind of sit there and talk about, like, I'd show him some work that I had done. And he would give me notes on it, which is, like, absurd that he watched some, like, horrible movies that I made. but by the last one, he liked it, which I was like, okay, good.
Like, was that
so bad.
Was that day one or was that later?
that was day the first thing I showed him was like, at the American Film Institute, you have a 2-year program. The first year, you have to make 3 kind of in-house films for like almost no money and really quickly, and it's done on purpose so that you make mistakes, essentially, and learn from them. Almost like an old studio system. Mm. And he saw the first thing I made there, which was like, I mean, I hadn't made a movie in like at that point in like I don't know since well before the Army, and it was just terrible. It wasn't terrible, but it was like. Like, I don't want anyone to watch it,
let alone, like, George Lucas. Hero, yeah.
Yeah. But he was kind about it. He pointed out, like, here were some good things. And in fact, he actually pinpointed something pretty early on that, like, he didn't say this, but he basically was insinuating that I was having a confusion as to what kind of filmmaker I was going to be, and that you had to decide if you were going to make a film for fellow filmmakers and film lovers, or if you're going to make a film for a general audience, and like kind of who you're telling this story to, because there's essentially different types of languages for either. And sometimes a film is fantastic and it kind of, you know, the Venn diagram overlaps and you can do both. He gave me an example of his first 2 films and how they were basically the same story, although one's in a kind of dystopian science fiction, one in THX 1138, and then American Graffiti is like kind of the first teen coming of age, like we're about to go to college movie. But it's about, they're both about escape. And he said by the time he made American Graffiti, he realized that he wanted to talk to as many people as possible. And he could convey that same idea of escapism that he had in this dystopia that was kind of, it's almost like sterile and off-putting. He could find a new way to say the same thing. And he was right. He'd identified that like, there were elements of my filmmaking that was like populist and also like probably trying to be art house or something. And so it was a good question to ask because it really, you know, how do you like communicate with your audience is the real question.
What did you decide between those two? And did he change your thinking on that or just crystallize your thinking of what you wanted to do?
When he asked me the question, which I knew was a rhetorical question, so I didn't say anything in response. Which is good, but the answer that you would hear from like other filmmakers or maybe I'd heard in the kind of like filmmaking culture was that you make films for yourself, and there is some truth in that for sure, but it's also, I'm sure he would have said, it's a cop-out, because like that's fine, you should always make them for yourself, but then how are you communicating with these types of with what language are you going to communicate that? And I think it's a very it's a question, I think, that, you know, it bifurcates filmmakers, which way you're going to go. And so for me, I don't know. I think if I had never joined the Army and had just gone to make films, I might have, like, made a little more esoteric work. But something about coming into it later in age, I appreciate stories that have a more populist point of view. I think that you can really affect people, more people, with a kind of broader brushstroke. And that's not always a bad thing or a good thing, like The Godfather, for instance, or Dances with Wolves, or Heat. I love those movies. Those are very big, epic movies. But they're painted with a broad sort of approachable sense of storytelling.
And this was so this was right before the Film Institute, or this was while you were there?
I met him first before I went to school.
Because like, you worked with him for like over two years, right? It was a pretty long...
Yeah, 2 years. Yeah, we had a few meetings. And then what was also really helpful is that, I mean, he has created an incredible company up there that he then sold. But I got to meet a ton of people up there who were incredibly generous and just awesome people. I met Lynn Hale, who's like... head of their PR, and a few sound designers, Matt Wood and Dave Acord, who like ended up working with me later on because we just got along and they were like super into helping me for some reason. I never quite understood it. I was always like so suspect of like, you guys are like really nice. What are you doing this for? I just couldn't believe it. They ended up doing the sound on day one, and Lynn organized it so that I could get some visual effects work from ILM.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was like, more than just, his mentorship, it was like connecting with all his people as well.
That's incredible. I mean, I can't imagine them. They must not meet people with your background that often either, right? You must be such an oddity for them.
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, it's, I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this. Like, you know, to you, it's like, it's no, I shouldn't say it's no big deal, but it's not something you really think of twice in terms of like how your service relates to you and your life. And like, but to some people, it's just a, such an alien concept.
Yeah.
I know, like, they're like, you spent 2 years in Afghanistan? And it's like, yeah, and it's like easy for me to think, yeah, of course I did. It's what I did. And then like, but for them, it's like, why would you do that? Not necessarily like it's like any question of like the job or such, but like why anybody would give up 2 years of their life for something. And this is like, you know, I think it's hard for, I mean, but at the same token though, like whenever they give me that, it's like, I always think about like, you know, my mom's been a teacher for like 30 years. Mm. Like she's been, you know, doing a lot over a longer period of time. It's just that what I did was like really compact. Mm. You know, it's just that I think that's the thing that people are so, intrigued by.
Yeah.
Is how it's like, we just like, instead of, you know, committing to a lifetime of say like of teaching like my mother did, and where you can see the effect of that, like or the sacrifice of that per se, I mean, I think back to my time in the military and it's like, you know, you do actually give up a lot, like personal relationships, you know, and you're not around your family that much. So I think they find, that to be very intriguing for sure.
Hmm. And your film Day One, when did you first have the idea for that? Was that percolating back when you were in the Army, or is there a moment
sorta
that you can kind of pinpoint as the conception of
totally
this idea?
So on my first tour, I was at Camp Keating in Afghanistan. This is up in like Nuristan, like Hindu Kush type stuff. And I had been at this remote place, Cop Keating. And then for a month I had to go back to like the main base. It was like our platoon had the rotation of being like the battalion effort or something. It doesn't matter. Anyhow, so I was hanging out above the, I guess it was called Charlie Med. I don't even know what it's called anymore. But I was talking to some surgeon, some major, don't remember his name. He was smoking a cigar. I was really cool and smoked cigarettes at the time. And he was just telling me about a woman that had just come in recently. They said that a husband driving a Hilux or a pickup truck with his wife in the back came to the front gate. And basically, like, you know, when they like kind of lifted up what was going on, it's like, oh man, there was like this child sticking out of this woman who's stuck. And so he just talked to me about dealing with that. And I thought, how interesting, how immediate and how visceral. And so then on my second tour, I had a female interpreter. She and I became great friends. I was a platoon leader again on my second tour, a specialty platoon that we basically did counter IED and, some targeting, of bomb makers. And so I had this like kind of motley crew of military working dogs, and like we had PSYOP sometimes, we had EOD, a really interesting, you know, Afghan and American infantry. Anyhow, I also got this female interpreter, which she was really useful in terms of dealing with families, because that's really what you're, you know, part of our work over there was like essentially police work. And so knowing how to like, hey, can I enter your home, please? You know, and someone's saying, yes, you can. Okay, well, this is my interpreter. You know, she's going to go let your women know what's going on, because it's a big separation, as people understand. And so we were just kind of like tied at the hip for a year, you know, where, you know, anyone who ever heard me speak down there, like she was the one translating my words. She was kind of my voice for a year. And I just kind of fell in love with her in terms of I suppose it's a loose term. I don't mean it that way. you know, she's become my muse. I find her to be an incredibly inspiring person who, like, you know, my entire life has been privileged in many ways. I come from a great family who supported me, who lauded me with compliments, and gave me this confidence. I have a sister who I owe a lot of my confidence to, my older sister showing me the way. You know, and this was kind of the other end of the spectrum, where, you know, she was supposed to be this wife for somebody. It didn't work out. And so she could no longer be this thing. She was a divorcee. And in her community, that was kind of ostracizing. And so it's now she had to reach deep inside to figure out who she was and what was important to her. And like one way to like kind of both find herself and get away from all that was to like become an interpreter for the U.S. Army. She's a contractor, but you get the idea. And I just found that to be so inspiring that like what she was showing was an intense amount of integrity where, you know, it's and that's only earned through, I suppose, through failure. That it has to be earned through obstacles and overcoming them. And that is something that I find to be like one of the most poignant qualities of any human. Anyhow, so I basically just threw those two stories together and exaggerated some of the stuff about the birthing scenario. Not medically, but although there's a part that's slightly twisted medically, but I kind of made it worse than it was. And the original real life story, the child was actually already dead inside the woman. It had strangled from the umbilical cord. So I just made it so that the child was still alive and that it was a breech birth with the arm sticking out.
And I'll put the link to the movie in the show notes for listeners. It's 25 minutes. It's $2 on HD and I think less than $2 if you get SD. Really, really great. I'm just wondering, like, how long did that take to put together? What was the process like of creating this this film?
It takes forever. Filmmaking is a very slow process. It just inherently is. I would say that took me probably about a year to a year and a half. And part of that is because it's a collective effort as well. Insofar as, you know, you have to, I mean, there's phases. You have to write the film, and then you have to the production, the making the film, and then you have to like edit the film, the post production. And so in each of those, there's different teams that you work with essentially. And it's not a, you know, I'm not some singer, songwriter, or painter who like gets to do it on their own. Like you have to corral people and manage people. And that's kind of why I enjoy this process actually, is the collaborative nature of it and the inherent like team building and all that. That's really, I think what that combined with the sort of artistic aesthetic stuff is really kind of my Venn diagram where it overlaps. But yeah, I mean, it does take a very long time. There's just no way around it. And you have to be patient. And I hated the film for a very long time. I thought it was, it did not meet my standards or my tastes, but little by little, and that's how you do it. It becomes much better. It just takes a lot of effort, a lot of trial and error, and to realize that like failure is just an inherent part of the process.
What was the in that year to year and a half? What was like the worst moment? Do you remember like a moment of just hitting the bottom, or what that worst experience was during it?
I remember screening it for people, and I knew that I'd made some mistakes. It's inevitable, you know. And you can just watch people not. I mean, it's a big movie that goes for really big ideas, even though it's a short film. But I mean, it's about like violence and life and like. So when you aim high and you miss. It's really obvious. It's you kind of left out there hanging. And so I definitely felt that in that screening where it wasn't effective. People weren't moved by it. In fact, I think they were a little annoyed by some of the clunky qualities of the storytelling in its earlier versions. But that's how a work in progress that's how it works.
And you went back then, and did you have to like reshoot and re-edit and just kind of completely back
totally,
to the drawing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh. How many times did you film the entire movie?
So we had one big block of production, which was like 5 or 6 days. I think it was 5 days. And then I did end up doing 2 days of reshoots, which was significant. I basically made up a new beginning and a new end. And made sure that I had all of the, what I would call information for the rest of the film. Like there are moments where like, hey, I should be looking at this person's face and seeing their eyes and seeing what they're looking at. And I'm not. And so it's like, okay, well I need to shoot those moments of like getting reactions and getting those are the little bits that, like, you are all of a sudden with the characters when you get to see what they're feeling. And I've missed some of those beats. And also, like, working with babies, you know, it's difficult for a number of reasons, because it's super evident as soon as a baby comes on set that it's like, wow, you're making a movie. It's not as important as this 4-month-old. Like, it's this living creature that somehow is going to be a part of your movie. And it's like, there's the nurse who, you know, is there for the child. And then there's also a representative of, like, the union, like, because the baby can only work for like 20 minutes. And it's like this very odd thing. And so we needed more baby time, essentially, is why we ended up shooting some more of that as well.
I'm wondering, because you ended up bringing your interpreter along with you to the Oscars. Actually, before we get there, where were you when you found out that the film had been nominated for an Academy Award?
So the first thing you find out is when you get shortlisted. It's like when you make the top 10. I knew we were eligible because we'd won the Student Academy Award, how we kind of backdoored into the whole, like, Oscar thing. And I was at my wife was doing something, and I was like her assistant. She was doing a photo shoot, and we're both like kind of these like little entrepreneurs where we both work from home and have a bunch of little jobs. And so she was doing some, I forget what it was, but anyways, I was literally her assistant there running errands like a grocery store to get like enough food for the crew. And I kept getting all these text messages, and I was like, what's that all about? And then I was like, oh, you've been shortlisted for the Oscar. And I was like, holy cow, that's big. That's really big. And I just never assumed to go any further than that. But by the time that you are, they're going to announce the 5 on a specific time, date and time. It's like 5 a.m. or something like that of some morning, so that it can hit all of the international news cycles. And in that instance, I went to my producer's house at like 5:30 a.m. and we just sat on his couch and we watched it. We actually videotaped it too. It's on our Facebook page. Mm. And it was insane. I mean, it's I don't know. It filled me with a lot of anxiety, actually, because like it's you're like, wow, it's a big deal. You know, you hope that it's good enough, essentially.
And then between the nomination until the awards, was your life then about promoting the film and kind of getting word out there? Was there like, was that the start of just another segment of work, or what was that like?
Totally. I mean, there's like a whole industry built around movie making. You know, it's sort of like, I mean, I'm no expert on this, but I feel like in this many of the ways, like, the Brits have the royals for that purpose. Like, we somehow have Hollywood and like celebrity for that purpose. And so that was weird to like dip your toe or my toe in that pond. Cause yeah, it was kind of a full-time job of like getting a publicist and like doing screenings and a lot of good things came from that. I mean, I got work from that, which is great. I mean, it was just networking in a lot of ways. But you know, it was, yeah, I mean, there's all these like press junkets and weird Hollywood things where like, this was so funny. And it was like to like give you an idea of like kind of the scenario, you know, like they're like, oh, you had great, congratulations, you should get a publicist. No one says that, but like you should. And you're like, okay, cool, I have to pay for this thing. And it's like, I made a small little short film. I don't have money for this. Like, how do you do that? You know, and then like, so we figured out a way to do that, you know. And then they're like, hey, do you guys want to go to these place to get free stuff? And I was like, what are you talking about? They're like, you can go to this thing called the gifting suite and they'll give you free things and let's take your picture. And I was like, that's stupid. And I thought, yeah, but I could sell that stuff on Craigslist and eBay. And so I literally did. Cause like, that's like, as a young filmmaker, like basically what happens is like, you don't know when your next gig is. And at that point I was like, oh man, like totally, we should do that. And so I literally went to this gifting suite and that's where I got everybody's Christmas presents. And I sold a few things on eBay. Like that, incredible. to help pay for the publicist.
That's so funny.
So absurd.
Literally just finished this audiobook of Anna Kendrick's book, latest book, and she was talking about when she won the, or was nominated for the Oscar for Up in the Air. It was similar. She's like, I had no money. I had no money. And on top of that, I had to buy a $1,000 pair of shoes. And it was just like, it's just kind of like this, leading dual lives where you seem like you're, you know, you're on the red carpet.
It seems so glamorous.
Yeah. And she's like sleeping on a couch at the time, you know, it's crazy. Yeah. What was it like to be at the Oscars, and especially having, you know, not just your family there with you, but this interpreter who was the muse, it seems like, for the movie?
You know, that's huge, man. I mean, it's, you know, it gets difficult because you only get so many tickets and a bunch of people want them. And I mean, there's no way around it. Feelings get hurt in some ways, but I always knew that she had to go. I mean, it's just, we have this incredible experience together that's, you know, there was, I would wear a dog's leash on the back of my body armor so she could hold the other end while we were on patrol, because one time she kind of got, I wouldn't say left behind, but the potential was there. And I was like, where the hell did she go? You know, and she's not a ranger qualified. Like, she's not like some infantry dude, you know? So it was like, you know, nothing. She's just tired. She's like falling back. And it's like, oh crap, we can't do that sort of thing. And so for this whole year, we had this like umbilical cord, like that connected us. And we just became deep friends. Like, she and I talked together on the phone, I'd say, I don't know, once a month for hours at a time. She's honestly one of my closest veteran friends, especially from that second tour. That first tour, I have a bunch of other lieutenants that we all stayed really close with. But that second tour, she's probably the closest friend I have from that. The big issue was whether or not she never told anybody that I'd made a movie about her. You know, she didn't tell many people that she'd worked for the Army. It's a little bit of a sensitive subject. You know, it's, and history is littered, by the way, of people just like her who have like somehow like bridged that gap, and like for better or for worse, depending on how history rewrites it, you know, or whatever, like they're in the middle. And so it was a big deal for her, that she basically came out at the Oscars, about her service and, about this movie. And she's in an awesome fashion. She had this like Facebook post with the world's most interesting man that said, it was a little meme, it said, I don't always go to the Oscars, but when I do, it's because they made a movie about me. and I thought that was just so good. And it's like, you know, there's like a lot of weird stress things that come from like all this attention, but, being able to take your wife to the Oscars, being able to take my interpreter and like give her something like that. One of the like most unadulterated good feelings I've ever had. I was like, that felt great to be able to share that with people, for sure.
And you know, one thing what I just wonder what it's like after that, like as you look forward to just right out of the, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it seems like right out of the gates to have, you know, between George Lucas and then this Oscar, like to have had such high moments. I wonder, like, what is next for you? Like, how do you look at the road ahead? And you talked about the networking and all the opportunities.
Sure.
I'm wondering, like, what was it like the next day? And then, like, what is next for you on the horizon?
Sure. The next day was a big sigh of relief that it was kind of all over in some ways, because it does take over your life. And, you know, there's a great fear of what if we win and have to say something, you know, even though like, it's funny, you know, with a little bit of distance, you can go, I mean, look, all that is incredibly important. But it's also like, it's just another thing. It's not real. It's not like any more real than the conversation I'm having with you. Like, it's just, that's all in your mind and how you deal with all of this, attention or scrutiny. But the only thing you can really control at the end of it is like how you deal with it. And so I would say that on my better days in terms of moving forward, I try to remember that this is a marathon, and this is about a game of perseverance, and that although I need to be ready to hit the home run every time I'm up at bat, I have to understand that I'm not always going to do that, but that I can, and I still have that ability, and to just keep going to bat. That's my better days, I think. You know, but there is, you know, the expectation is that like, you know, I have an agent now, and, I'm trying you know, for like basically around that time period, I was shopped around and like met people and maybe we could work together, maybe so on and so forth. And it's difficult because those things don't always work out and you're trying to figure out how to make your way. And so I think that the best advice I've gotten was to just try and figure out what it is that you like so much about that thing you made that everybody else so liked. And try and harness not the same idea, but just like, what is that thing? What is that point of view or that unique quality that they enjoyed? And just like go back to that, you know, you being in a little room trying to figure something out. So that's kind of where I'm at. But in a professional sense, I was working with a guy, Ian Bryce, for a little while. He produced Saving Private Ryan, and we were trying to come up with a TV show. But he and his people are fantastic. But this guy you're talking to now, I would say I was too young for it in a way that like going from a 25 minute piece to like trying to write out and develop a basically the great American novel. It might have been beyond my depth, or I should have found not that they weren't collaborators, but like another writer and like worked it that way. But it just kind of didn't. Never could quite figure out the way to approach it so that we could get something fresh out of the subject matter. But after that, I've just been trying to develop a feature. And that's kind of my plan moving forward is that I need to now make a big feature film. And, you know, I'm paying the bills presently writing that and doing commercial work. I just made a commercial for the Navy, actually.
That's awesome. Yeah. Did you try and sabotage it as a former Army guy? Or was there some subliminal message?
Oh, no,
in
man.
There?
I was kissing every sailor's boot heel to be happy to have a job.
I love your explanation about that, though. I'm such a big fan. Elizabeth Gilbert has a book called Big Magic, and I think mm-hmm. it should be required reading for any entrepreneur or artist. And she just talks a lot about she mentions a lot about Harper Lee with To Kill a Mockingbird, and just
yeah, think about that, yeah,
yeah, like wishing, like why, you know, I wish she would have like the fear of producing a work after achieving all the recognition that Harper Lee did, and it's like why, you know, if only Harper had written a cookbook or just done something, even if it didn't have to live up to that height, just to do something to create again, and how the world was robbed by not having that creation until, you know, recently that came out. And I wanted to ask you as well, you know, other resources or advice that you would point veterans towards if they want to go down this path. What else have you learned or benefited from that they might want to look at as well?
Interesting. You know, there are, I would say as a veteran, I would capitalize on all the resources available to you. It's insane. Like, we're kind of like this, I mean, I hate using this word because I don't want it to be true, but in some ways we're treated like super citizens, you know, whether it's free healthcare or I get to go talk to a counselor once a week for free. She's not even part of the military VA system. That's something they do. You know, like that's tremendous. Or that there's like American corporate partners who will find you a mentor. I mean, you may not get as lucky as I did or some other people who also got like some guy got Tom Hanks, by the way. But you know, you'll find that there's like people who are willing to mentor you, and that is helpful to develop those relationships. Here in Los Angeles and in New York, there's a thing called Veterans in Film and Television. And it is just a community of a bunch of us trying to make our way. And you know, it was founded by veterans, and it's a great place to like kind of get a lay of the land. And I think that is very helpful because, what I was so shocked to find of exiting the military. In the military, I knew how to be good at what I, at least be perceived that I was good at what I did. You know, like you could go get your Ranger tab. You could, you know, get a good OER. There's report cards. There's this whole structure. But outside of that, at least in my industry, it's super nebulous, and you don't know how to move forward, how to progress. There are no like, there's no tiered system. And so understanding, like, you basically have to get, like, your feelers out there and trying to say, so what is this? Like, how do I be – like, I know what I want to be in 10 years. How do I achieve that, you know, or how do I get closer towards that in 2 years, in 3 years? And, you know, it's like that part is difficult, and you have to like do your own work in many ways, because no one is going to be able to tell you, for no other reason, probably the fact that they don't understand what you need as much as you do. But you have to kind of figure that out and figure out how it is that you can navigate that, because no one is going to take you by the hand, you know, in a way that maybe as a junior officer, people kind of took you by the hand. Like, you don't want to admit it maybe, but they kind of did. You know, we all had like super NCOs who showed us the way, or like, you know, other, you know, whether they were colonels or whoever, that had a direct impact on like your maturation and like your growth as a leader. You know, like you don't find that you have to cultivate all that yourself when you're outside of the Army. And so I would say cultivate away and like try and make those relationships.
Yeah, it just strikes me. I had another conversation with a veteran, Chris Pestel, who went into photography, and he was a photographer for ESPN. And, you know, and similar to your path, both of you being in the arts, it's just the most extreme example I can think of going from structure and clear delineation and very, very organized to being beyond on your own and having very little roadmap and just completely, it just seems like the biggest contrast I can think of to a military background.
I think so. Although I can't compare it to much other, I guess, but I mean, I've noted that myself. That said, I would say that the military did me a huge favor in, you know, instilling confidence in me and like teaching me what leadership is and how to manage things, to include my own time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all of these sort of life skills, and although we're lacking a lot of them, like I still don't really understand how health insurance works, for instance, you know, but
no like, one does. Yeah.
But, like, I do understand that, like, hey, if you want to achieve something, okay, like, you know, this is your task. You got to find these implied tasks. Okay. These are the obstacles. Okay. How am I going to overcome them? Like, just managing like that. Like, I feel so, I guess, blessed in some ways that I learned a lot of that in the military, you know, or like learning how to like deal with conflict. Like, that's a huge thing for anybody who's in any profession, is interpersonal conflict. You know, you get a master's degree in interpersonal conflict in the military, because you were surrounded by people all the damn time, many of whom you don't get along with, but you are, you know, required to work with. And so you learn how to navigate that professionally and efficiently. And that by far is like, I would say like been something that sets me apart from other people. When I look at my filmmaking peers, like they don't really necessarily have that experience. And so that there are a lot of, and it's a soft skill, which is tough because you can't like, it's not going to get you a job, at least not like in the traditional sense. But I'll tell you what, I think it will be something that in the end, like, gets you a career.
That's great. Well, I know we're running short on time. I always like to leave the last question just open-ended of any other like final words of wisdom. It could be about personal life, professional life, or anything at all. But what would you say to the veterans and active duty personnel listening right now?
I just started going to therapy about a year ago. And I wouldn't say that I thought I was crazy or that I had post-traumatic stress, or I honestly don't even like putting a label on it. But I knew that there were parts of myself that weren't working as well as I wanted them to, that I was kind of stuck in the past about a few things. And I thought, okay, hey, look, like, you want to be a real professional, you want to be a real filmmaker, you want to be a father, like, get your shit together. Like, and it's like at your fingertips. And I looked up this thing called the Soldiers Project. Is that what it's called? It might be called the Soldiers Project. Let me check that. I think I'm pretty sure that's right. And what they do is like they give you free therapy. And I've been able to talk with someone for about a year or so. And I would say, if you think you should talk to someone, or if you feel like there's something you can improve upon, don't be afraid to go do that. Like, it's super interesting to find out about all these things about yourself and understand these experiences you've had and like how to relate to them and how to understand them, how to deal with them, how to cope with them. Because there's like a whole part of me that was like, I'm fine. You know, like, so I saw some violence, so I committed some violence, like, it's all going to be fine. You know, like, I'm a tough guy. But you know what? Like, there's something about holding all that in that's going to limit you from reaching a greater potential. And I would highly recommend whether you find therapy in talking to some of your old friends or with an actual therapist, I would recommend taking an active role in trying to improve yourself.
Oh, I 1,000% agree, man. I feel like whether it's a coach or a therapist or a counselor, it's you know, in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that highest pinnacle is self-actualization.
Totally.
And I feel like the greatest luxury that you can have is to – you can literally pay someone to just listen and help you better understand yourself. And everyone, non-veteran, like everyone on the planet could benefit by having that sort of resource of someone to just really challenge you, point out things that you might not – realize on your own. And I think it's such an incredible resource that it's unfortunate that sometimes it does have a negative stigma in our society, but I think it's like, man, it's a luxury.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely agree with everything you said. I mean, I think if you want to improve yourself, you can.
Yep.
And it's really helpful with somebody else.
And I always think of, like, dude, no one goes to the Olympics having self-trained. Like, these people have coaches that are pushing them and challenging them and giving them tips. And it's like, dude, I want to be in my professional and personal life. I want to be at that Olympic level, not physically. I don't have that aspiration.
Totally, yeah.
But like, why not have someone who can help me think around corners and help me if I can in 1 hour get through 10 hours worth of realization, why not? Like, time is too valuable. Make
exactly,
it more
efficient. Yeah. And if you look at it just from that sort of like problem solving point of view, it's the obvious choice.
Yep.
So, yep. I mean, the only thing is people I think are afraid, and for good reason, because you're going to have to confront things that you don't want to talk about, that you don't want to feel. But the fact is, I don't think those, I kind of said it earlier, you can't outthink those things.
Yep.
Like, you are like, the machinery of you as the human is gonna beat your mind every time. Like, it's just, that's not possible.
Yep. And I imagine, you know, for all of us, the times that we've learned the most and gained the most have been the most uncomfortable, some of the most uncomfortable and challenging, intimidating experiences. And,
absolutely.
You know, yeah. Why take the easy route? Like, dive in and figure that stuff out.
You know, it's funny. There's this whole, like, thing in the military about failure that you know, the military is pretty binary, right? You know, it's like good, bad, success, not success. Like, you have this thing of like failure is a bad thing. And it can be, especially in the military, the stakes were super high, you know? And so, but what they did a great job of was letting you fail in much less risky environments. But if you ask anybody, I would assume that they would, the biggest lessons they learned are probably from the times they failed.
Yep.
So you have to like go into the breach essentially and say like, yeah, there's going to be a lot of crappy things I'm going to talk to this therapist about that don't make a lot of sense and just frustrate me. Mm. But it's in confronting those failures that I'll be able to understand and like become the better version of myself that I would like to be, whether that's personal or professional.
I love it. I love it. Well, for listeners, I'll have notes in the links in the show notes to everything we discussed, to the film, to where you can learn more about it. And Hank, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's really a very unique story, and I think it's very cool to showcase what you've done and show other veterans that that's achievable.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. As we wrap up, I wanted to share three quick but important announcements. First of all, if you haven't already, please sign up for my newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io. Although I publish on LinkedIn and Facebook, I'll be starting to use the newsletter as my primary means to share new articles, episodes, and resources relevant to the veteran community. Second, I would love to hear from you. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a relationship where I do all of the talking. You can view me as your very own dedicated resource to help you and other veterans in your civilian career. Have feedback on what I can do differently? Let me know. Someone in particular you want me to track down for an interview? I'm all ears. Know of another way that I could help the veteran community? I'm dying to know. You can find me on LinkedIn, comment on any post at beyondtheuniform.io, email me at justin@beyondtheuniform.io,
Or if you're in the intel industry, I'm sure you can track me down in some super creepy way. However you do it, take me up on it. I thrive on feedback. Lastly, a quick plug for a few resources I think would benefit any veteran. American Corporate Partners and Service to School both provide free assistance to any veteran. American Corporate Partners pairs you with a mentor in your desired industry, and Service to Schools finds a mentor at a suitable undergrad or graduate school program to help you with your application. Check them out. As always, tons of great content and resources available at beyonduniform.io. I'm Justin Nasiri, and I'll be back soon with more great episodes.